The title today, as you can see, is Assessing the Developmental the Developing Child. I'm Jane Holmes Bernstein. I'm the director of the Neuropsychology Program at the Children's Hospital in the Department of Psychiatry. I'd like to start by unpacking my title. It's very important to remember that titles and words have very different meanings, and it's useful to make sure that everyone's on the same page. We are going to talk today about assessment of the child, okay? And the word assessment here is being very explicitly contrasted with the notion of measurement. You measure a child's abilities. You assess the child. They're very different activities. Now, in the modern era of psychological measurement, it's interesting to note that there is data suggesting that the measurement of abilities for such things as civil service, for example, goes back to the early Chinese dynasties. But the modern era is usually thought to have started with the work of Binet. Binet's work originally was, in fact, related to the child's ability to perform according to age-expected levels. The achievement of behavioral milestones was what Binet was trying to capture, with a view to assigning kids to schools. However, the whole issue of the measurement of abilities rapidly became anglicized and even more rapidly became Americanized, and has had a very important and fairly lengthy history at this point in the context of American science. I think that the biggest single impact of the Americanization, if we can put it that way, of measuring children's abilities is it rapidly did become very much skill focused. We therefore became very interested in cognitive constructs and what they were, and we rapidly developed a psychometric paradigm in which we were interested in fact analyzing behavior with a view to proving or disproving people's view of how cognition broke down. So it's a very much a cognitive skill-based paradigm that we've been using for measurement ever since. And certainly the Wechsler scales, which I think are the archetypal measurement tool at this point, are built in that fashion. There are some problems with the psychometric paradigm, however. That the biggest one for the clinical assessor is that the standard measurement of children's abilities is actually focused on inter-child ranking. How does this child rank relative to others in the same cohort, where cohort is typically, at least for the really good psychological tests, if we put it that way, is typically a standardization sample that is widely sampling the population at large. Okay. But it's important to keep this notion of ranking in mind, because what the numbers are telling you as you look at them, especially as you look at them over time, is that if the child maintains the same quote-unquote IQ number, what that actually means is that the child is staying in the same place relative to the other kids in the cohort, which may or may not be a measure of some sort of biological intelligence, if that's a meaningful phrase, but it needs to be recognized that that's not precisely what has been characterized. Now, the clinical analysis, i.e. when you're looking at an individual child, is one that is necessarily an intra-child analysis. And for this, at the present time, I would argue that psychological tests are very important. We cannot do our job without them, I think, to a degree, but they're not sufficient. They're not sufficient in some very important ways. First of all, psychometric models fail to model the neural substrate. In other words, they cannot capture what you're really interested in, which is how the brain is doing this. If they can't model the neural substrate, then obviously they're not going to do a particularly good job at situating behavior in the context of childhood neural pathology, or brain damage, or brain difference. They're also not very good, because of the nature of how they're used, at tracking developmental change. They can be used to do this, but they don't do it themselves. They essentially provide snapshots of a child's performance at a given point in time. From my point of view, the most important feature of these, perhaps, is that lacking the ability to do all the rest, they have no role to play in furthering our understanding of neurobehavioral development, which is ultimately what I personally am interested in. in. I think it's important to notice that some people go into a job like mine because they're really interested in helping Susie Jones or Billy Smith or John Brown. Some of us, on the other hand, are very willing to help Susie and Billy and John, but we're really actually interested in how brains work. And Susie and Billy and John are, if you will, the fodder that give us more information about how this actually happens. Now, the other thing, there are some other points we should make about psychological tests, which are worth further discussion if we wish to go in that route. Psychological tests are billed as objective. And in a sense, they are, in that they are administered under standard guidelines in specific sorts of contexts, etc. But unfortunately, people tend to overestimate their objectivity and forget, or if they ever thought it through, that they're not really that objective and can be influenced. The performance of a child on a psychological test, however standardly administered, can be heavily influenced by parameters of the situation that people normally call subjective, or I think to get rid of some of the value judgments inherent in objective and subjective, we might want to think of the difference between quantitative and qualitative aspects of performance. The other issue about psychological tests is they are constructed to do what they do. And the very construction of the tests has some implications. So, for example, the most important feature is that they are constructed to reduce variability. One is trying to find a central tendency on the curve so that you have an idea of what the construct is that's being measured. Okay? This is an interesting problem that many of you may be familiar with in one aspect of it, and this is seen in the fact that we have a tremendous difficulty designing tests or constructing psychological tests that measure the behavior of children under six, the preschool contingent, that have decent predictive validity on the psychological tests at the age of 10 or 14 or 15. Right? It's not because we're not good at doing psychological tests. We're also good at doing these sorts of tests by now. PsychCorp is no longer a cottage industry, has had a lot of experience. The problem is that the animal, the preschooler, is a very variable organism and is not easy to fit into the psychological test requirements. It's very interesting that children, once they hit school, become very well socialized. And there's also some reason to believe that somewhere around the age of eight, when, as Byron Rourke once noted, Rourke's precise comment, I believe, was, it's only about the age of eight when predictions based on the adult neuropsychological model start to work for children. And many of us would argue that that's because prior to somewhere at seven, eight, or nine, neurological development is such that the brain is not yet, quote-unquote, integrated, which is the characteristic feature of the adult brain. But it's interesting that you see the psychological tests obligingly start to work better in terms of these issues of predictive validity for later. Psychological tests are, by the way, also heavily focused on cognition. That's what they were built to do, or that's what they've been developed to do since, as I pointed out, they became Americanized. It's important to recognize many of you may, in fact, end up in the classroom at the front, and many of you may already have been at the front of the classroom teaching. For a teacher in the classroom, a child who has a cognitive disorder may not be noticed for quite a long time. This is one of the problems of kids with learning problems, is they may not get noticed. However, that is not the case for a child who has a problem in the other huge domain of human life, which is that of regulation. A child with a regulation problem that makes him or her unable to maintain themselves on an even keel in the way expected of kids of that age is likely to provide major difficulty for a classroom teacher trying to manage 24 other children. Okay? Psychological tests do not do that. All right, so they're not, they certainly can't be part of a total evaluation just on that basis. We do have psychometric instruments like rating scales and questionnaires that go after the regulation issues, but they're not the tests themselves, or not typically known as tests. So you can see that if the psychological tests aren't as objective as advertised, and that maybe some qualitative features of testing are critical, if they are constructed in a way that reduces the variability so that they may be minimizing information that you need, and if they're over-focused on cognition and there's a whole other domain that you need to know about, not just one possibly, then it follows that psychological tests are going to be blind to a variety of behaviors that are actually critical for making a diagnosis. All right, making a coherent diagnosis, we would say. So, psychological tests themselves are necessary, but not sufficient, and we need to think about what else is needed. To do that, I'd like to unpack the word assessment a little more and make it very clear that for me, assessment is not coterminous with the word evaluation. If you read the literature, at least in my literature, and I think also in the educational literature it happens also, the words assessment, evaluation, and testing are often used more or less interchangeably. For me, that is not the case. Assessment is the overarching clinical activity. It is no point, there is absolutely no point in doing an assessment if, having done the evaluation part of the assessment, you don't have something useful to do on behalf of the child. Therefore, management is necessarily a part of the assessment activity. I'm finding it, personally find it more and more irritating to read reports that are terribly elaborate, beautifully word processed, you know, justified in all possible directions with nice bolding or italic font and everything, and they look terrific. Report of neuropsychological assessment, and either they sort of stop dead having put a child into some sort of nosological category defined by the DSM-4, which is one problem, or a nosological category defined by the education system, which is, not inappropriate, I suppose, or they say, this is the diagnosis, and then they give you what I call like a Rolodex of interventions. There's no obvious reason how this particular set of interventions match this diagnosis. It's called in my program the B problem, because we go from A to C without any explication of why we've done that. My bottom line is if students are going from A to C without knowing what the B is, then they don't understand my discipline or neuropsychology or assessment in general. So we're keeping it very, very tight the way we're using the word. Assessment is the overarching activity that does something for the kid. You have no right to be spending $2,000, $2,500 of somebody's money, insurance carrier or parent, evaluating a child and having nothing available for it that makes a difference in the child's life. I was reading a recent volume, and I like the phrase that this writer noted, the woman who was Natalie Rathbone, and she noted that a lot of assessments have no intervention utility. And I thought, that's a very interesting comment, that the first thing we ought to have is intervention utility, I think. Notice that the word testing isn't even on the slide. So assessment is the overarching activity. Evaluation and management are the two sides of the same coin. If you will, the learning about what to do and then the doing it. Testing is a subset of the evaluative process, just to show you where I would have it. Now, we are indebted to Matarazzo. Matarazzo is a very significant contributor to the assessment literature over the years, and he was president of the American Psychological Association in 1989, and in 1990 they published his address to the association. His presidential address. And in this, the title of the article is Psychological Assessment versus Psychological Testing. And I think one can put neuro at the front of both of those psychologicals, and it's equally true. And in this, he says that the measurement of psychological function is not a totally objective, completely science-based activity. And as you can see, I put the slide on, on a slide, so I obviously like the quotation, but as I've been looking at this quotation over some years now, I've realized that I'm not totally happy about it, because whilst I agree with the theme that the measurement of psychological function is not simply dependent on the tests, which is what he's talking about at some level, I'm not sure that I really appreciate this flavor that if you're not totally objective or completely science-based, maybe you aren't quite so rigorous. And I personally resist intensely the notion that the qualitative analysis of performance, the non-test-based examination of what a child is doing is lacking in rigor. In fact, I would argue that qualitative analyses and qualitative research itself requires a possibly a higher degree of rigor because there's more hanging on the competency of the observer, i.e. the clinician. You can't just sort of say, oh, the tests say they're very robust, blah. You have to have a very well-founded theory. And not only do you have to have a theory that generates hypotheses that allow you to test what you think is going on, but you need to know, you need to have a good grounding in things like the design of the assessment and the ability to control for bias. We'll come back to this. Matarazzo followed on by saying, the assessment is a highly complex operation, I entirely agree, extracting diagnostic meaning from personal history and objectively recorded test scores. I think that's rather interesting, objectively recorded test scores, because doesn't he want them objectively given? Or maybe he knows that it's not so easy to be totally objective in the giving. Anyway, he pointed out that history and test scores were critical, and I would like to include very specifically the whole notion of observing behavior. And I'll be showing you some instances of this as we go along. Let us start by looking at the goal of the evaluation itself. We're going to be thinking about evaluation and management, evaluation first. First of all, it's not a profile of cognitive skills. I'm using, this is the face sheet from the WISCAR, the Standardized Intelligence Test. I'd like to tell you that I just ordered WISC-4, which is out and ready to be used, and has got some interesting changes, one of which is that we're de-emphasizing the verbal and performance IQs in favor of indices, which I think is going to be quite different and interesting to see how it works out. I'm using this here as a placeholder, if you will, for a psychological test profile, irrespective of which psychological test. The goal of the psychological test, of the evaluation, is not to put the numbers onto that sheet, which doesn't give you a great deal of information. But what the goal of the evaluation is not that sheet of paper, but this. Okay, this is the Tootsie Roll, the little soul for whom you are going to do something useful. Let me remind everybody, because you may not think of these in this terms, although some of you might, is that I do not sit in my office, or at least I don't leave my office, looking for patients. Everybody who comes to see me has, by definition, something wrong in their life. Why would they jump through every hoop necessary to get a modern American insurance carrier to pay for them to come to a tertiary care medical setting if something isn't wrong, all right? So no matter what is wrong, it's my job to actually state such. You may be amused to hear that one of the complaints that the education system often, not the system obviously itself, but individuals within it, people will make statements of the order of, well, I don't know why you go to Children's Hospital. If you go to Children's Hospital, you always get a diagnosis. Duh. I thought that's what they came for. That's what hospitals do, right? Of course, what they mean is that you get a learning disability diagnosis or whatever, and so the school is saying, we don't think the kid has a learning problem. If you go to Children's, they'll give them a problem, which is sort of silly because, of course, they have a problem if they come to see us at Children's, and our job is to tell them what it is. However, not every child who gets to me has a problem in the neuropsychological domain. I mean, there are times when I say, I can describe this child's neuropsychological profile, but I don't believe that that's the variable that's getting the youngster into trouble right now. I think the child has major psychiatric problems and we need some major psychiatric support here, or basically there's a medical issue going on that I think supersedes the neuropsychological problem. I'd like to point out that given the nature of the referral bias to, or the referral pathway to us at Children's, I don't say that very often. Usually a kid who has a neuropsychological problem has neuropsychological and psychiatric problems mixed up together. But it's important for my feeling that I'm doing my job properly that every so often there's a kid that you say, this is not neuropsychological. because that makes you feel that, oh yeah, I am able to say that, even though at the end of my referral pathway I don't get to say it too often. Okay? So, the name of the game is you need to say something useful about this little Tootsie Roll, and presumably, since she has a problem, we need you to make some recommendations that will help this child along. And if you can't do that, maybe you need to reevaluate your career choice. Now, assessing a child, all right, of course, what we're doing here, as in any assessment, is we're assessing a child's behavior. This is the, not actually, this is, we are past the decade of the brain. We're now in the decade of behavior, I understand. Still, however, appropriate to remind ourselves, what does behavior? And in 2003 in the United States of America, there's no question, but everybody will agree that this is what does behavior, the brain. Okay? Bringing the brain into the equation requires, I believe, that one thinks about what drives brains. And in asking the question this way, I am really very explicitly asking you to think about the building of brains as a group of entities, i.e., how did the mammalian brain become of the shape it is? How did the human brain develop from the mammalian brain? So one is very interested in an evolutionary approach to the study of behavior currently, and one is therefore interested in a lot of comparative neurological work or neuroscientific work. It is the reason that I'd like to ask this question very explicitly, you'll see in a little while anyway, because it is important for my view of the world. But I think it's important to recognize that the reasons why children come for clinical attention have to do typically with not being able to read, not being able to do math, not being able to organize their assignments, and not being able to do written work. Okay? None of these symbol systems have been used by the human brain for long enough for them to have species changing parameters. In other words, they have not, our brain has not evolved to cerebrate in this particular fashion. Now, just to be very careful, because I know everybody in this room probably knows even more than I do, because you're all younger and have, you know, more brain cells to spend on these things. Everybody in this room is now well aware that experience changes brain and in the individual. So we know the work of the phantom limb behavior. We know the will, blocking the guy's name, Ramachandran's work. We know Michael Merzenich's work, where we know if you, for example, tie together the two fingers of a monkey brain, you can show that the brain that works the two separately stops working them separately and merges together. We know that if people who are blind, their visual cortex, or what would normally have been visual cortex, is co-opted for other sensory systems. Okay? There's also a very nice study that was done comparing siblings, women, sibling girls, one of whom, or some of whom, had exposure to reading through the education system, and others, for social reasons, did not. And that there are differences in the individual brain as a function of the experience. That can be true without those changes at the individual level yet being in the whole species, in the gene pool for everybody. Okay? So, we haven't had enough time to change our brains to have reading packaged brains for everybody. Okay? So you have to stop and say, okay, well, what does drive brains? What is it that we share? What do all brains have that we take with us everywhere and that we actually use all the time in spite of all of this emphasis on cerebration? Okay, cerebration, I mean like symbolic cerebration. Dr. Geschwind was very well known when he was alive for giving marvelous lectures, and one of the great images, shall I say, that Norman gave us was the four forces that are actually driving brains, and he used to talk about the four F's. And the fourth one, of course, is fornication, not what you were thinking. Usually, we'll see how quickly people pick it up. Anyway, these are the variables that are really important to how brains work. Because if you stop and think about it, nature, to anthropomorphize somewhat, nature's only interest in brains is creating more brains. So mating, reproduction, is the major force that drives us. But in order to mate, you have to look after yourself. Right? So there's survival of the species is rapidly backed up by survival of enough individuals. Notice that nature doesn't mind if she drops a few off the edges as long as the mainstream keeps going. So the sorts of biological drives or behaviors that are critical for these activities are going to be very central to how we work. Now, I like to tell a little bit of a story here just to sort of give you an idea of how we really do work. Think about, do a sort of thought experiment. I always love there are certain things that have come from the physics domain that have influenced psychology for good and bad, but certainly the notion of the thought experiment that the physicists use is a wonderful idea and really reinforces the notion that great psychologists need imagination. We need other things as well, I think, if we're going to be pretty good, but imagination is a useful one, especially imagination to engage with what is the life of a little child and how you can feel. Imagination and empathy are critical here, of course. Okay, I want you to do a thought experiment. I want you to put yourself back on the savanna. You are a hominid, you've come out of the trees, and you are now on the savanna trying to make a living, stay alive, in this new environment. Okay? You're on the savanna and there are a lot of grasses. Okay? You are walking out along the savanna, quietly minding your own business, and of course, because your brain does this all the time, you're going. There is a constant awareness of your environment, right? Now, I don't know where you're going to be watching this particular segment when you actually do, but wherever you are, as long as nothing untoward happens, your little or vigilance or distributed attention system will operate normally. If, however, there was a sudden funny cracking noise behind you, I tell you, this goes down really well in Southern California, then there is nothing that will keep your attention on me, because in earthquake-prone countries where buildings actually do crack, the only thing you will need to do is get out. Okay? So this vigilance, this distributed attention is working all the time, and it is critical for your survival. Right, so, okay, we have distributed attention along, all right? Now, notice that one of the important things about the distributed attention is you are actually looking for something that the brain is geared to do extremely powerfully, and that is look for novelty, right? And some of the most interesting work, I think, in our whole domain is the whole issue of novelty in babies and how we've been using that novelty habituation paradigm to work out what little souls, very, very little souls, actually can and cannot do. So the chick-chick-chick system is monitoring the environment, looking for something different. Important feature of brain performance is that brains work on difference. Bam! You see over there, the wind is moving that way, but there's something making the grass move the opposite way. All right? So your chicka-chicka-chicka system continues, but now your focal attention system holds on that. Right? And before you can habituate it, say, oh, nothing much, you have to look at that and say, okay, what could that be? Access my memory banks. Have I seen something like this before? Right? Memory comes into the picture. You then say, when I remembered it before, was it actually worth my while running and expending all those calories in order to get what was edible at the other end? In other words, there's some animal in there making the grass go the wrong way. Or is it that there's just a wind eddy, so that when I dash there, wasting all those calories that I badly need, am I not going to have anything? Or is it possible that the movement of the grass is so large that if I run like hell there, I'm not going to get an animal that I can take on my own? So do I need to get my social cohort to help me? Right? Notice you've got your attention system, your vigilance system going, your focal attention system goes in to respond to the novelty. Okay? You access your memory system, you evaluate whether it's worth it, right? What's my caloric state? Do I need the food right now? And you consider, because you are a social animal, whether this is something to engage the group in to get the activity. And then maybe you say, eh, and you effectively habituate and carry on chicka-chicka-chicking or going wherever it is you're going. So this is how the brain is working. It's thinking in terms of feeding you. It's monitoring your caloric status, which, of course, it relates to motivation, and it's relying very heavily on previous experience as a measure of or an index of whether it's worth going for something else. Right? Put the child in the classroom. All right? You have a child in the classroom, and what you're supposed to do now is we have language, which is really a very important skill, of course. But we have, let's say, Mrs. Smith in the classroom, and she's like me. She's a woman, motor mouth, talks on and on. And this little kid in the back of the room is not very good at tracking language. There are children who have no particular problem on individual tests of language or in individual syntactic structures or semantic use, but they can't do it fast. Right? You're sitting in the classroom and you have this rate of processing problem. Mrs. Smith is in the front of the class and she's a fairly high-speed talker. Mrs. Smith says a sentence. Our little soul here, Susie, gets about 90% of the sentence. But that's fine because language is so heavily redundant, she knows what's going on. But Mrs. Smith gives another sentence. And in this one, Susie only gets 70% because she's still processing the last bit. So she only gets 70%. And she moves on to the third sentence. And by this time, Susie's only got about 40% and she's starting to not know what's going on. And Mrs. Smith keeps going. Right? What is the problem? Rapidly, Susie can no longer follow what's happening. Now, what does this mean in real terms? It means that the stimulus out there is not strong enough to allow Susie to maintain selective attention, right? The focal attention that is always attention plus the ability to process something, okay? So what will happen? Susie is a working animal, right? Attention is not holding over there because she can't process it, so what happens? Well, she doesn't switch off. Attention is still going, chicka 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 chicka. And so what happens? Susie's brain is looking for novelty again, because that's what brains do. And wouldn't you know that today is the day that Jimmy next door brought in this brightly colored Game Boy toy, which is just tucked in the top of his bag. And Susie sort of sees this bright orange color, and she's, like, really interested. And next thing you know, Mrs. Smith is looking at a child who's actually focused down. What does Mrs. Smith do? Mrs. Smith says, Susie, pay attention. Now, if Susie does something like this often enough, Mrs. Smith is going to become aware that Susie has a problem paying attention because she does it all the time. Right, Mrs. Smith will tolerate the odd example of this in kids. She knows what kids are. But if she keeps hearing herself tell Susie to pay attention, then a very interesting sequence goes into effect in this world we live in. We have the four P's. The teacher tells the principal. The principal brings in the parents. The parents are told to go to the pediatrician, and the pediatrician hands out the pill. Not the pill, the other pill, known in our day and age as Ritalin, okay? Now, let me make it very clear that when you've gone through this sequence of four P's, I have no problem with Ritalin. Ritalin is a remarkably benign agent, okay? It's worth probably just letting you know that parents get very bent into knots about Ritalin because they worry that you have to keep giving it. You have to give it in the morning and you have to give it at lunchtime. But let me point out that the fact that the kid has to have repeated doses of Ritalin can be a social problem for the child at school and things like this. But the fact that you have to keep giving it is actually one of the best things about it. It's because it washes out so fast, right? So it actually has a 3.5-hour half-life, and so every 4 hours you need to pump more into the system if you want it to work. Right? We now have, as many of you may know, several different delivery systems for Ritalin. Most of the new drugs basically are delivery system changes to try and keep the Ritalin coming in doses over the course of the day, for example. Ritalin works very well when it works. Doesn't work for everybody. I remember seeing a child with Martha Denkler many years ago now and learning something important when this 8-year-old said to Dr. Denkler, he said, you know, it keeps me up at night. My mom says, and I know, I don't go to sleep. She said, when I don't have the pill, He says, it feels like there's someone in my head. Sorry, he feels like there's a television in my head and somebody keeps changing the channels. Which I thought was a wonderful description for an 8-year-old person about an internal experience, which is what we think the Ritalin is addressing. So that was rather good. The other nice thing about Ritalin is you can actually, if you use it properly, you can actually find out very quickly whether it's going to work for somebody by, you can actually challenge somebody by titrating the dose over the course of a weekend. So as drugs go, I mean, it's a very benign drug. It's not like the other psychiatric drugs where you may have to, you know, work for 3 weeks up to get to a working level, and then you have a long dropout period if you want to take the child off. Anyway, that's a very long circuitous route to just sort of remind you that brains are... I shouldn't leave it without saying the one important point about this. In the scenario that I just offered you about Susie, you might notice that the attention problem is not primary. In other words, I set up a scenario for you where Susie is having trouble processing the language so that the linguistic stimuli are not an adequate hold for attention to be maintained, right? The problem with that particular story, or the problem it sets up, is that if you give Ritalin to this particular kid, you're likely not to get an effect, which means she's likely to be a non-responder, you know, and then that can carry a certain set of complicated issues with it. But the other issue is more pernicious, which is you haven't addressed the problem that caused the issue in the first place. In other words, this is a child for whom language modifications need to be made, not Ritalin needs to be given. Okay, so here's a good example of how understanding how the system is working in real life, if I can put it that way, allows your diagnostic window to be much wider. And if your diagnostic window is wider, then the sorts of recommendations you may make are also likely to be more varied and broader. Okay, so I'm setting up a bit of a theme here, I hope, which is that brain may be enough. It may be necessary, but it isn't enough. It's not sufficient to explain what we're trying to do here. And I think you can think about this very concretely by referring to what I'm sure is a fairly substantial neuroscience base in all the people here, that brains do not get built initially, nor do they develop over time, nor do they continue to function in a vacuum. Okay, brains... If you put the owner of a brain in a black box from the moment they come out of the womb and leave them there, they will be able to do nothing. Not motor, not sensory, not language, not thinking. They won't work. Okay? Because the brain is absolutely dependent on context for eliciting its function and shaping it. Okay? Now, let's explore this notion a bit, because there are lots of interesting things about the brain-context interaction that we really want to keep in mind. I'd like to ask you the question this way. Can you have dyslexia if no one ever asks you to read? And here I'm using the word dyslexia in the correct way. Dyslexia is a highly specific, definable disorder whose primary symptom is inability to acquire reading in the same at the same rate and in the same manner, possibly, as other people of similar competence and opportunity. Okay, we do find the word dyslexia being used as a sort of wastebasket term because it sounds nicer than being slow learner or mentally retarded or other things that people don't like too much. So what does everybody think? Can you have dyslexia if no one ever asks you to read? Can you have dyslexia if you don't live in a society that is seeking universal literacy? Well, I think there is an answer, and my answer is absolutely no, you can't. Okay. You can have the biological vulnerability that would set you up for dyslexia, right? But if nobody ever asked you to read, how would we know you had it? In other words, you have to demonstrate the symptom of dyslexia. Dyslexia is a disorder, a manifest symptom, a manifest change in expected behavior, all right? And there are people, myself included, who have a protocol, a neuropsychological protocol, that ought to have led to a reading problem, or at least is very commonly seen in other people who present with reading problems, and I never had a reading problem, and I'm one of these people who can spell. I'm one of these people who doesn't understand what the problem is about spelling. It's obvious. I understand it's not obvious to everybody. Okay, now, notice that what we have done immediately by setting up the question this way and the answer this way, we've made a very specific statement about how we are going to understand the word learning disorder or learning disability, LD. Learning disability is not a property of the child. It is a property of the child-world interaction. I was reading something recently by an educator who was making a very interesting point that the special ed system in the United States, one of the features of the system which has been problematic is that the whole emphasis of the special ed diagnostic process has been that the problem is in the child. And that has had the unfortunate, one unfortunate outcome, which is teachers have tended to say, well, it's in the child, there's nothing I can do. Right? This, of course, this model we have on the slide right now is a very good model, I think, because it says, oh, yes, there's a great deal you can do. And it's not, you don't have to bandage the child alone, you can do a lot for the world. So it has tremendous implications for what you might be able to do. Now, what is a learning disorder? And what I'm giving you here is a definition from a paper by myself and my colleague, Deborah Weber. We argued and have argued for a long time that a learning disorder is indeed a failure to adapt to the environment. Okay? And it's the, you know, one person can have a neuropsychological profile that you would have thought might set them up for trouble, but could have a lot of other things in their life going on that are positive, so they never actually fall into the trap, if you will, of the learning problem, whereas another person with exactly the same neuropsychological profile could be having major league difficulties. All right? I learned this, and many of you, I'm sure, will, once you get to my age, you'll remember that how you learn the points. I learned this once by we evaluate children in two sessions a week apart, typically. And so in the second session, for this youngster, I was doing some academic testing. I have to tell you right now, there's a very good reason why I don't do academic testing. You have to sit there for ages waiting for the kid to slog their way through some reading test that may take 15 minutes. But this was a 13-year-old, and I had very little option but to do that. There weren't any other reading data available for me to rely on. And what was interesting here was that I was completing the scoring of the previous week's testing while I was sitting there, you know, waiting for this period of time to be over. And I suddenly became aware, I was just going through the numbers, and it suddenly dawned on me that the psychological profile on the WISC, the IQ test, was essentially the same as my psychological profile on the WAIS. When I first started out this game, way back, I had somebody give me a full neuropsychological evaluation. I operate on the principle that if I'm going to be doing this, I ought to know what it feels like to have it done to you. So I actually know what my neuropsychological protocol looks like. Okay? And I suddenly thought to myself, you know, this is just the same as mine. And then the question came to me, why am I on my side of the desk and he's on that side of the desk? Now, I'm quite willing to tell you I have, everybody thinks it's completely silly, but I actually am learning disabled. No, sorry, I shouldn't say that. I actually am subtly language impaired. I have a very nice vocabulary and I'm highly articulate, but if you listen carefully, I make some interesting language errors. And I have a neuropsychological profile and indeed a motor system to go with this from a neuropsychological point of view. And that's about as far as I'll go. I'm not about to tell you the psychopathology or psychological whatever that allowed me to achieve independent of this neuropsychological profile. We don't all have to. Sharing and self-disclosure can only go so far, right? Anyway, the issue here is people do, with the same sort of neuropsychological profile, some people run into trouble and other people don't. Right? So that's a reason in and of itself for assessment being an individual game. But our notion was failure to adapt to the environment. That irrespective of what your skill package is, the question is, can you make it match what they're asking you to do? If you can make it match, no problem. If you can't make it match, this may be a learning problem. We're neuropsychologists, we're working in a developmental model, that's how we chose to interpret this. Now what was very valuable to us was when I found a little later a paper by Jerome Wakefield called The Concept of Mental Disorder. Any of you who are planning to go into the clinical arena, you really ought to read this paper. It's a very nice analysis that I don't have time to go into right this minute. But basically, Wakefield came out with a very similar picture. He said that basically, a disorder is something is a bit different about the system, i.e. dysfunctional. I mean, you can interpret that as broadly or as narrowly as you wish. But dysfunction alone is not sufficient to account for a disorder. The dysfunction has to create a situation which the owner of the brain, or the family of the owner of the brain, when we're talking about kids, experience as harmful. And until the dysfunction gets in your way, you're not going to experience it as a problem. Okay? I think that another point that I'd like to make here that is a very important point for me in working with families is there's no such thing as a normal brain. Right? If you mean by normal that you are equally good at everything you ever tried to do, then obviously nobody has a normal brain. We all have talents and untalents, and most of us avoid having a learning problem by avoiding our untalents. All right? In school, you're sometimes pushed to use your untalents, but almost everything we're asked to do can be done in more than one way. And so there's ways, different ways of solving the same problems with different roots. Now, the other point on the slide here you'll note is this phrase, learning disorder. I just thought I would put it there to remind me to point out to you that we're using the word learning disorder as opposed to learning disability. There's a reason for this. We're not the only people who sort of felt it was important. The word learning disability has been codified, or the phrase learning disability has been somewhat codified by the feds in the various federal guidelines for what constitutes these problems. So that learning disability tends to, in most people's minds, refer to the academic skills, the application of the skills in the academic arena. And so we wanted, in a neuropsychological model, to go beyond that. We weren't just interested in whether you couldn't read or not. We were interested in what can the brain generate, what things can go wrong with the brain that would actually be manifesting problems in learning specific behaviors. And so the word disorder is used to capture that larger, anything that the brain can learn or has to learn could potentially generate a problem. And so that's what we're using it for. So, where are we? Well, what we have here is the beginnings of theoretical matrix for guiding the work we're doing. First component of the matrix is brain as the substrate for behavior. But brain cannot be understood or analyzed, the impact of brain, without reference to the context in which the brain finds itself. So we're dealing now with the brain-context interaction. Let's just make a few more comments about context, because people don't get this, in my experience, as well as you might like them to. Context should be understood as something that elicits, shapes, and supports behavior. I think there's a very important point to be made to say that behavior is actually an emergent property, if you like, of the brain-world intersect. Okay? We have in neuropsychology, of course, we've codified it as brain-behavior relationships, which in retrospect is actually an unfortunate phrase because it suggests that the brain mediates behavior all by itself, which I don't think it does, as you can tell going on from here. What constitute contexts? I think you need to think very seriously about the physical context. And you need, from a developmental perspective, to consider for every brain system, or indeed for every gene that has to send its message to get the system to unroll, that physical context can be the hormonal environment of a certain set of cells. They can actually be at the level of, you know, a regulatory gene that will set off a cascade of important events that lead to behavior can be derailed or can be set off on one path versus another as a function of 1 degree Fahrenheit difference in temperature at the time that the gene is ready to send its message. So we're talking about very fascinating, and very sophisticated and subtle gene-environment interactions at that level. And, of course, we're also talking about the hormonal environments that the baby grows in long before it actually gets into the physical environment of the world. And then it has to interact, the young organism, with the sensory inputs of the world we live in. I mean, there is a very important way in which we do live in the world with light operating at these wavelengths and sounds in these domains, okay, in these ranges. Anyway, that's a huge discussion all by itself, which I won't go off on, except to remind you to think that the physical context is a very elaborated thing from top to bottom. And you also need to think about the psychological context, because we have good reason, for example, now to think of that social bonds themselves, especially the early one between an infant and a caretaker, can set off or derail the development of a young brain from the very beginning, and in terms of behavioral interaction between the mother and the baby. And I'm sure everybody is well known, you know, knows very well the early work of Harlow, who demonstrated with the rhesus infants that they didn't actually want, or they weren't supported, I'm looking for a word that isn't coming here, they weren't nurtured, they didn't find nurturance in the wire image of a rhesus mother who had a bottles of milk where the breasts would normally be. These infants found nurturance in terry cloth. They didn't even look very much like monkeys. They were just boars, as I remember from the original pictures. What I found interesting was reading again some of that literature, and just make it very clear for those of you who don't remember this so well, is that basically these infants who were taken away from their mothers early on were severely behaviorally impaired and had no idea how to socialize with other animals later, and were reproductively incompetent. And from that point of view alone, you know that nature would have just gotten rid of them. Out you go, because you can't do what you're supposed to do to be a monkey appropriately. But there was actually some interesting later research. As I say, I only just reread some of this lately, and was entertained to find out that Harlow had done therapy with some of these monkeys, and he had put these impaired monkeys, these deprived monkeys, into a social situation with other young monkeys. But what he had cleverly done is he had put the damaged, if I can put it that way, the behaviorally damaged juveniles in with rhesus monkeys that were several months younger. And so they were therapied by little monkeys who were socially competent but did not create a head-on collision, like I've got to check out, you know, shuffle around, check out my edges, as the older animals would have done. And that some of these therapied monkeys actually did much better as adults. They were able to be in the pack as a whole and weren't rejected, and I don't know how successful they were reproductively, but... So these social bonds between caretakers, infants, and then infants and their peers, or young animals and their peers, are absolutely critical, and we have a lot of data now suggests that brain is developed differently. For example, also, I think another domain that's quite interesting is this whole issue about children of depressed mothers. Okay, there's a whole other domain in the orphanage work too, for those of you who are interested. But there's this very interesting issue in depression. Is there a familial vulnerability to depression? And apparently the data, I don't know this literature terribly well, but apparently the data is much stronger for a familial genetic link for anxiety rather than depression. But the issue is, are the children of depressed mothers depressed because they're carrying a gene? Or are they depressed because mom's depression means that mom is not facilitating the child's behavior because her behavior isn't contingent because of her problem? And these kids, when you watch them, are known to, they learn behaviors that don't challenge their mothers. But they may be withdrawal behaviors that are artificially interfering with the natural mechanisms that do withdrawal and approach that are brain-based. So you can add on, you know, to social, the whole emotional issue, and emotional experiences can change things like motivation, sense of self-efficacy, which are critical for learning and engaging with the education process itself. And I'm not talking about education in school, I'm talking about education in life. So they can change how the brain does. And it's very important to think about beliefs and goals and values, because these change what expectations are on children. There's a fairly substantial literature, for example, on the maternal mother's responses to children with learning disabilities. These children are often behaved with in ways that do not challenge the child. The expectations are dropped, okay? All of which should have immediate, for those of you who think clinically, all of these have immediate possibilities for intervention, what you need to do in order to counter some of these in kids with problems. Just to sort of put it in context, we're looking at people and environments, I think, just to reinforce it. And notice that the context goes from the child, we've already talked a little bit about the internal relationships of brain systems, to the examiner. Remember that in a situation, an evaluation situation, there's always an examiner, and the examiner is a critical entity. But you need to think about, as we've talked, peers, family, and then society at large. I like to just make the people context emphasis on peers quite, I like to emphasize it and highlight it. Why is the peer group important? Why is it that in taking a history and interviewing the mom and the child and doing your psychological tests, why is it not good enough? Why is your interaction with the child not sufficient? Why do you need data about the peer group? Right? Well, the answer has specifically to do with brain, and brain in context, of course, but brain, is that your brain, when you talk to a child, is older than theirs. It may not actually be brighter than theirs. You often see kids who are way beyond you in intelligence, but the problem is, not the problem, but the thing is, you've been in the world longer than that child, so you know more. Right, and sometimes I don't know, many of you might be parents, and those of you who are parents, especially with older kids, will know that sometimes you have to sit down with the child, a very bright child, and say, look, I know Mrs. Smith is not as bright as you are. She's not always very sensible, but she does know more than you. And so you need to behave and not treat her like she's an idiot. You do have these bright kids who need a bit of help in this way. The reason why the peer group is important is that they have brains of the same age as the animal you're looking at. And the question is, how do brains of the same age and competence manage this child? Those brains may reject this child. Those brains may ignore the child, or those brains may carry the kid along. The issue is those brains are developing. And at some point in time, they may be a lot friendlier than they can be later. The classic example here is the very odd child who is carried by the group through the elementary years. There's always some girl, I'm thinking of a particular boy right now, there was always some little girl who would mother him, and the boys would do that. They'd sort of get, come on, you know, Christopher, let's go, we have to go here. And they would look after him. However, the problem is, as the normal cohort move into adolescence, they have so much to do themselves, managing physiologic changes, managing social changes, interacting differently socially, there's nothing left over for the odd kid. And of course, everybody knows that the big theme of the peer group in adolescence is we all have to look alike, God forbid we should look different, and a child who's clearly on a different trajectory becomes very odd and unacceptable. So it's very important to know how the peer group are dealing with the child to get a flavor of how odd or incompetent the child is perceived as. You also need to remember that the people context has society in it as a larger construct, and our education system is critical to this. We are asked to see kids who, by and large, are not, who are failing at their job. The job of children is education, learning in there. The education system has enormous impact because it is teaching you to respond to the social order, it's teaching you how to be productive, and it's teaching you features about citizenship, behaving appropriately with other people so we can live in a group. So these variables, because they're so powerful, have tremendous impact potentially on kids. Okay? And so you have to take them into account when you are evaluating, because they may be part of the picture. Now, one of the points you should be taking in, or as one goes along one should, is that if I am correct and this brain context interaction is critical, then in trying to diagnose or understand behavior in front of you, then you cannot rely on an approach that says, okay, I've got to find out what the brain does here, what the brain does here, what the brain does here, and what the brain does here. What you have to think in terms of much more is rule out everything that might explain this behavior before I take refuge in a brain model. Right? And that's rather important in working with children, because brain behavior relationships in children aren't neatly, you know, defined like they are in adults. Okay? All right. And you also need to consider, we've just mentioned it en passant, that you might need to think about who you are. Because you're part of the context with this kid and you're contributing, not only are you contributing, but your behavior is probably changing in response to the child. You need to know what's good about that as well as what's bad about that, because that's a tool that you can use for evaluation. Okay, well, we've only got part of the story and we need to move along. What is the cardinal feature of the child? Well, it's not the brain. Everybody's got one. It's not special to children. We've all got brains, I think. The cardinal feature of the child is this. You have to go from not being definable outside someone else to a cheeky little toddler to the cool soccer player, and then on to an adult male able to produce children himself. This is what is critical about the animal, that it develops. Okay? So our theoretical matrix is not in fact going to stop at brain and context, but we have to have the whole notion of development. And development is change, dynamic change. It is not simply time passing. I think that everybody, I think there's now, I hope, consensus on the fact that development is change and critical. It's not linear. How you exactly think the dynamicness and the change operates, I think there's still argument. People have different views, but I don't think any serious scientist is talking about linear anything in this domain anymore. For clinicians, possibly the most important feature of the construct development is the notion that what you are seeing now is an outcome of the developmental course to date. So anything that happens to this child before they get to your office is part of who they are. And if it has brain-changing capacity, the brain changed and the changed brain continues to develop with the child. Let's quickly review brain-behavior relationships, just to get a good sense of this. Neuropsychology, the study of brain-behavior relationships, started with a where question. Brox and Dacher in the 1860s said, oh, isn't it interesting that if you have a damaged brain in the left hemisphere, then not only will the right side of you not work very well, but you'll have problems with language. Okay? Wernicke comes along a couple of 20 years later and says, aha, it isn't just a left hemisphere language, but depending on where you are in the left hemisphere, it can be different types of language, the where question. And so localization theory was born, brain behavior relationships got rolling. The problem we have as working with children is we don't have the situation that the adults had, i.e. brains that were developed had holes punched in them by disease. The sorts of diseases that we have to contend with are the what sorts of processes are used to put the system together. Okay, cell migration and assembly, can things go wrong with that? Sure they can. Synaptogenesis, the creation of the contacts between cells, the information system, can things go wrong with that? Sure they can. Myelogenesis. Myelin is essentially the insulating tape of the nervous system, which allows information to be transferred around the system efficiently, cleanly, without noise. Can things go wrong with that? Sure thing. Lots of things can go wrong with that. The problem is, when can things go wrong? Well, they can go wrong at 2 days post-conception. Before mom has any idea she's pregnant, there could be rather nasty little chemical things that go on. And some of them are, of course, not compatible with life. Some of them are fully compatible with life, and the child continues to develop, but may be very damaged when they arrive. But they can have a problem at 6 months of gestational age. Many of us think that premature birth itself can be construed as a toxic insult. Birth can be problematic, 3 months of age, 4 years of age, 15 years of age. The point here to think about that is if you take a hit in a given what, at a given when, you may never get the where means the expected adult reference brain behavior relationship. Okay, and as a clinician, you have to keep these in, you take the history of all these possibilities and you have to keep in mind what the where or the membership of the where might possibly turn out to be. Now, not only is this the case that we have more problems that presumably will yield over the next 50 years to some research, the problem for the brain-behavior relationships in children is, are the constituents the same? In other words, do the same parts of the left, when does the left hemisphere become preferentially committed to language in most people? That the language left hemisphere brain-behavior relationship is perhaps the most well-known one at this point. But even if you can make a statement like the left hemisphere is critical for language from this point on, you still have a question about the architecture. In other words, let's say that the left hemisphere is committed to language and the right hemisphere is committed to whatever else it does. At what point do they talk to each other? And how? The architecture within the system once defined to some degree. And I am not about to go into this here, but this whole question, or these two questions, are incredibly complicated once you take into account one of the big discussions in the literature, the difference between connectionism versus modularity and the relationship between them, which I'm not even going to go in because I could spend the whole day just talking about those. However, I will point out that we do have some interesting data at this point from lesion studies from Elizabeth Bates and her colleagues over at University of California, San Diego. They have made some very interesting systematic studies of kids with early unilateral stroke. And what they have contributed, among other things, is that the left hemisphere does appear to be critical to support language functions quite early on. What, however, is not so clear, or is clear, I shouldn't say that, it is clear that the pattern of the adult brain-behavior relationship is not seen. That what they see initially is what are posterior functions in the adult are disrupted initially by frontal lesions in the young child. Okay, so that suggests, among other things, that the brain systems that you mobilize to learn the skill may not be the brain systems that you mobilize to maintain the skill. And that's an important point to make. It may also have to do, given this particular pattern, that again, I'm not going to go into this in detail, but I'd love for somebody to think about it for a whole lifetime, if you would, is maybe you need the frontal systems to learn things initially because those systems are very heavily involved in effort. And you may be looking at an interesting distinction here between the need for effortful processing versus automatic processing. What is the difference between learning the skill initially, but then knowing, packaging it in a way so that it's more easily manageable with fewer resources once it's a routinized skill? However, just to keep everything balanced here, guys, brain context interaction, I would like to point out to you that you need to think very seriously about developmental processes operating across the skills that are being acquired. That these emerge, they're stabilized, and they're maintained. Okay? And Maureen Dennis, a very elegant description of how things, what the pattern of normal behavior is and what sort of disruptions can happen in these sort of categories. But my point here is to remind you that development isn't just a property of a biological system, it's also a property of the behavioral acquisitions. So you're seeing right now that we're having we have a very complex job on our hands. I mean, to be useful, I personally am not terribly interested in the performance of the young brain in the MRI tube. I have to deal with what does this kid do when they're in the real world. So I'm looking at online behavior, which is necessarily in response to demands in the context, the contextual element in the environment. I have changing neural structures that are changing under developmental maturational mandates, that they're also changing under the mandates of the interaction with the functional skills. This is a model that I won't go through in detail. I think you can read about it just as effectively. But the point here is to highlight that my colleague and I, when working on these data, now I look at it, it's more than 10 years ago, that we realized after a little while, I have to say, that trying to go from the adult brain behavior relationships and do a downwards extension to the child, trying to understand the child, really was not the way to go. And our decision was that what we really need to do is we need to say, okay, what is neuropsychology? Unpack it. Pull the neuro apart from the psychology and think about those two domains, run them through their own developmental filters, if you will, and then bring them together into a developmental science. And we believe that developmental neuropsychology is more usefully thought of as a member of the developmental neurosciences than as some sort of subset of adult neuropsychology. To the extent that that's a clear distinction. But that for that, what that means for us is that the things at the core of your model need to be features that are core of developmental models, structures, development, processes, and the context in which they operate. So we are going to operate now. The two major themes that guide everything that I do is how does the brain work, which we now have a strong feeling of brain context interaction, and how do children develop? And I'm not going to go through every last thing in the literature. Both literatures are enormous. What we do in evaluating children is we do an experiment with an N of one. The design is very much the experimental design. Therefore, we require a theory. We require a design also, by the way, and a methodology. We need to collect data rigorously, like everybody else. And we need to understand the function, the operation of bias and variability and control for them, or at least know they're there. Okay? For us, the sources of data for an evaluation are history, observation, and testing. I loved it when I found out that this was a hot model. And the reason for emphasizing that, everybody does history, observation, and testing, they will tell you. We give them equal weight. All right? We do not use history and observation as moderator variables for what we find on the tests. That is not what we do. The domains of behavior, all neuropsychologists are looking at the domains of behavior in some sense like this. The executive control processes, the knowledge bases that you have, and the achievement. I would like to point out to an audience that may be very exposed to the academic or educational world, is not just talking about achievement as educational or academic achievement. One is also thinking about social comportment and societal, the ability to respond effectively to societal rules. Remember that a large amount of psychiatric work is done with people who fail to respond to the social rules and therefore hit the legal system big time. Our diagnostic method, we review neurobehavioral systems, we evaluate systemic interactions, and we identify behavioral clusters. Let me just quickly give you an idea of what I mean by reviewing a neurobehavioral system. Basically, I am going to look at this child, and I'd like all of you to spend a few moments not moving on, if possible, and just looking at this child and telling me, what can you tell me about this child's brain just by looking at the picture? You don't have access to the child talking, you don't have access to the child walking. Nonetheless, you can look at this picture and you can tell me a great deal about this child. And if everyone is doing the exercise, I think that the first thing, think to yourself, what's the first thing that came to my mind? And I will take a bet that almost the first thing that comes to almost everybody's mind is what the kid can do. Psychology has a long history of looking for deficits, but good evaluation starts from what can this child do? And intervention is critically based on what can this child do. Okay? So what can this child do? Well, first you want to stop and say, okay, about how old is the kid? And is it a girl or a boy? Those are sort of useful things to start with. Most people say the child is somewhere between 4.5 and 6, and indeed she was 5 and something. She's a little girl. Okay? Most people can make the age judgment quite well by looking at the general size and the general solidity or form of the child. For a 5-year-old person, she's doing a lot of things that good 5-year-olds should do, and I'm just going to review several of them. Many of them you may have picked up yourself. First of all, she can sit up straight. She does not have to waste energy. I shouldn't say waste. She does not have to use valuable brain resources simply keeping herself upright. She has adequate postural control. And I'm not going to do my well-known example of the child without postural control. Suffice it to say that when you see a child who doesn't, a lot of the behaviors look like hyperactivity, inattention, distractibility, because the kid can't sit still. And so, as you know, ADHD is a likely diagnosis, even though it's not relevant whatsoever here. You might also look at this child and say, she's more or less symmetrical. She's balanced. Two arms are coming to the watermelon. She's holding it adequately. There's no strain in her hands because she's just holding it comfortably. You look at the legs. They've got adequate bulk and tone on the muscles. Look at the little face. The apparent bossing of her head, which somebody commented on, we think is a lighting effect. But if you look at the face, it's more or less symmetric. So you're looking at symmetry throughout the body, and you're looking at proportion. Okay, so the face has got the 3 face plates are normally proportioned. There are 2 other features of this child that I find personally quite entertaining, and that is the smug look on her face suggests that she's got a range of effectual competency here. She is aware. She's enjoying her watermelon. She's very aware she's being photographed, I think, wrong with it. The other issue is that you don't need to see her running around to know that she can. Look at her sneakers. They're filthy and the toes are hit. This is a child who is wearing out her sneakers fast. We, I think, can infer she's using that motor system adequately. Notice that what we did was we did a review of systems telling you what the brain can do. There may be lots of things she can't do, but we're not seeing them here, but we can tell you, as the basis for understanding things she can't do, what she can do. This brain has been developed normally, she's adequately nourished. I don't have to think about, you know, things that go wrong if you don't have adequate nutrition, for example. Okay, the adaptation systems, we look at the somatic systems, how well the system's developed, what is its current status, and what sorts of other things might have happened to the child. We look at the social systems, and we also look at the assessment systems. As I said to you already, the role of the situation itself plus the examiner play into what the child can or can't do. And we also need to consider test format and test construction under those variables. Some of the things you find in a kid are actually directly relatable to the test, not to the child. We then are trying to find a diagnostic behavioral cluster, which is a fuzzy set of converging variables. For us, it's a neurobehavioral system that it's focused on. Fuzzy set, for those of you who aren't familiar, isn't in fact some bizarre word I just made up. It belongs to something called fuzzy logic, which is a non-Aristotelian logic that I won't discuss any further. Those of you who want to know, go into Google or something. For the diagnostic behavioral cluster, however, I think we have to point out two things. That you are looking for two types of validity here. The critical validities for a cluster are convergent validity, behaviors that should go together do go together, and discriminant validity, behaviors that shouldn't be present aren't. And of course, if you're going to make comments about going together or not, then you have to have something that predicts what the packaging should be, which is another way of pointing you to the importance of having a theory of what you're looking at. Okay? Assessment is, neuropsychological assessment is particularly, is not atheoretical. You need to have something that guides what should be organizing your behavior. One would think that one wouldn't have to say that, however one does. Leave it at that. And again, just to reinforce for you that you are looking at the outcome of performance whenever you evaluate a kid. And it's your job to understand how the child's progress might have been influenced. We're also critically interested in ecological validity. And so one of the things that you need to recognize is that some of the performance you see in the clinical setting is clinical setting specific. And it is your job to understand what the implications of moving from the clinical setting to the real world are for the behavioral profile you're seeing. Okay, the ability to predict is rather important. Okay, so having collected all our data, what do? Well, we work with what we call the system circle, and basically here it starts out in the middle with the child world system. We are evaluating this particular child in this particular world. On the basis of the evaluation, we create a diagnostic behavioral cluster, which leads for us to a brain system as a shorthand for what's going on. So let us say, for example, that the brain system we've implicated in this particular case is the left frontal brain system. I have a cluster of behaviors that say, according to the theory we currently hold, that all of these behaviors are referable to something different about left frontal brain systems. Right? At that point, you go from left frontal as your cue under brain system at the top into my big box called brain. Now, this brain is actually not the brain of the child, it's the brain of the examiner, if I can put it that way. Or it is the total knowledge base of brain that the examiner could have access to. Right? So maybe you don't know it yourself, but you can certainly hit the web now and find out more. And you're going to go into that total data set of your training and experience and everything else that's out there and say, okay, based on what we now know, what do left frontal brain systems do? And armed now with a much fuller range of what this particular brain system can do, you return to this particular child world system and you say, okay, if the left frontal system does this and it's not working as well as all that in this child, then what will be the impact on this child in this family at this point in their education system and with these social supports or not supports? In other words, you go from a theory of the child's brain to a theory of this child's brain. You map between them. You map from the to the this, is the way I've been putting it recently. Based on that analysis, you can then say, okay, if this little soul is going to have to face his or her world with this particular package of difficulty, then I can tell you what he's going to be at risk for. I know the brain. I know the problem. I can tell you whether it will match or not. And if it's not likely to match, I can make recommendations to improve the match. And that's my job. That's ultimately what I'm here for. So, goal of assessment. The evaluation goal was portrait of the child. We had to capture this child so that we could understand how to work out how the child needed help in matching his environment. And the matching is, of course, this adaptation to the unique circumstances of this particular child. I'm using the total database of every child I know, so to speak, the child, but I have to make it work for the unique individual, so this child. Now, in management, this notion of risk is very important, and I'm just going to highlight it. For clinicians, I think it's important to recognize two things. Risk is just that. You may be at risk for things, but you never manifest it because lots of other things support it. Life is, behavior is very redundant in all directions. But basically, the job of the clinician, ideally, would be to see that you don't manifest risk. That would be, if you could minimize that all the time, that's your goal. Okay, let's just look at, to illustrate this, at Rudell's time-limited, time-reference symptom. That was a good Freudian slip, right? I looked at my watch and said time limited, right? Time, come along here. Okay, time reference symptom. What we're imaging here is the brain at the top and the world at the bottom, if I can put it that way. And the gap in the middle is the behavior or the symptoms phase. Symptoms are only behaviors, after all. Time is running from left to right. And what we want to think about here is the notion that this brain has a glitch in it, all right? I'm fond of using the example of the Piscetti kid. Okay, the little boy who goes to the, comes into my office one morning and is asked how old his brother is, and he says, oh, he's 10, it was his birthday yesterday, and we went to Papagino's and I have Piscetti. Right, always an attractive little error because everybody knows what the target was, and those of you who know the literature on humor will know that that's one of the issues, is when you can recognize the target from the error, there's a sort of dislocation or a dissonance that creates a sense of humor. The question here is everybody understands the Piscetti error, and the fact that everybody understands it allows you to analyze what's going on here. The error in Piscetti is one of having all the correct segments, but getting them in the wrong order. And we're going to use that as an index. Now, if the person who says to me Piscetti is a three-year-old person, do I care? Probably not. Three-year-old people are allowed a bit of leeway in this. If, on the other hand, the person who'd said Piscetti was the 10-year-old brother, would I care? Yes, I would. To the extent the kid is in my office, Piscetti being said by a 10-year-old who ought to be able to run these sequences perfectly well is potentially problematic. Okay, so take Piscetti as an interesting type of error. The type of error here, the kid who is saying Piscetti long past the time they should, get it right, is probably a kid who's at risk for reading grill for girl for grill, was for saw, i.e. sees the elements, isn't holding the order. Okay? But you can take that a little further. Let's say that that error is plunk in the middle of our behavior space. Think about how that type of problem, okay, this is a brain that handles the object, can get the bits, can't get the order to hold. All right? And push it back in time. How early in the child's development, could you have seen an error that would manifest this problem of I have to have the units but I can't order them correctly? Okay? Think evolutionary. What is the brain designed for? What are the critical forces operating on the child? You want to go as early as possible? Think survival. Right? Well, if you're thinking survival, you think about, okay, nourishment, you know, food, right? Think about the small baby sucking. It is quite common for children who appear with Piscetti-type errors later to have a history of failure, of poor sucking, right? Even though a female breast is completely covering the child's nose and mouth, and there is a huge proliferation of sensory inputs around the mouth of the infant, the perioral sensitivity is very, very well developed at that age. Even though all of the sensory sort of input is being triggered, the baby still can't get a rhythm going on the suck. And I'll leave you to think about all of the implications for the mother-child bonding that could engage. You find a little later, this type of child may be the child who has to be taught to suck through a straw, right? Or needs help blowing out the birthday cake candles. Both of those experiences for parents are extremely salient. If they've had a child for whom that's been true, it's been a real issue. Okay, and they know it happened. These are called oromotor apraxias, the inability to run the sequence of motor activities, even though they can run the muscles one by one. Okay, so what you can see here is as long as you think in terms of what the age-appropriate behaviors are, what the world is demanding of the organism at a given point in time, if you know the world's demands and you know the brain's competencies, you can predict what's going to go in the behavior space. Okay, let's very quickly just do this again. Here, I'm sitting in my office, I'm taking a history. This is an 8-year-old kid. I sit in my office, I take a history. Here's another kid, I'm sitting in my office, take a history. This kid's 14. Not to belabor the point, here's a 12-year-old, here's a 10 or 11-year-old. And lo and behold, I sit in my office and I start realizing that every time I get the same history, when I do the neuropsychological evaluation, I get a similar sort of, you know, I have the same category of neuropsychological deficit. I'm thinking, aha. And after a while, I stop saying, aha, and I think, aha, I've got something really useful here. Because here, when I take the history of this kid at 10, right, and I take the history and I say, uh-oh, this is the history that goes with this neuropsychological profile, then what is very interesting is the history does not simply operate backwards in time from the dot, the donut, back, but it also starts operating forwards in time. Because the history of the kid indexed there in red, the future, I'm sorry, of the kid in red, is the history of the child I saw at 14. The past history of the child I saw at 14. And so I have set now some way of predicting what this other child must be up against. And this is the concept of the natural history that's well understood in medicine, not so well used in psychology, that developmental change itself over time in this brain context interaction model allows for prediction, and if you can predict, you can prevent. You certainly can't prevent until you can predict to some degree. All right, very, very quickly, let's review how this operates. I sit in my office again, and kids come to be seen, and lots of kids come with academic problems. They don't actually come randomly. They come in packages. Basically, kids who appear in the office of someone like me that are still at the kindergarten level or the preschool or kindergarten level are kids who are having trouble learning to learn. Almost invariably, these kids have problems with regulation. Behavior regulation. They are not learning to regulate themselves, to comport themselves appropriately as other kids. By the time you get into first grade, it's basically decoding. It's learning to read at the decoding level. Then there tends to be a little bit of a gap. And by fourth grade, we have two groups of kids. We are, as you know, at this point, going from learning to read to reading to learn. And we have two groups of kids that are likely to appear. First of all, the ones who first appeared at first grade are likely to reappear because they may have had decent education, good, you know, services, everything's going right for them, and they're now decoding. You know, they're hanging on by their fingernails, but they are decoding, and if you give them a single word reading test, they can do it at grade level. However, what is typically the case is the effort required to decode is very high. They really are hanging on by their fingernails. And so they don't have much left over to comprehend, to work out what it was they're reading about. All of the brain resources are going on to the decoding, and nothing much is left over for comprehension. On the other hand, there's a whole other group of kids who are absolutely great at learning to read. They had no problem decoding whatsoever. However, they don't see the big picture or the main picture of any, the main idea of anything. And so they read blurbly along, absolutely beautiful, and still have no idea what they're reading. Right? A different group of kids, different types of comprehension strategies needed, and different types of intervention. By the time you get to middle school, however, it's sort of interesting. Somewhere around sixth grade, teachers start to expect kids to be more independent. You're allowed up through the fifth grade to be relatively passive and not be out there independently learning, but by the time you get to sixth grade, they start demanding it of you, and so the kids who are passive learners tend to show up there. High school, you're doing it on your own. The independence is really extensive now, and college, you're doing it by yourself. Now, Moving to this slide very quickly, and before, on the previous slide, the timeline was going down. All right, now you have to do a click on your head and make it go across left to right. Not under that other slide, okay, there were two things operating. I was imaging for you there changes in the content or the demand upon you, right? So over grades 1, 4, 7, 10 on this slide, you see that the context line, the content line is increasing by giving you more information to manage, more complex information to manage. All right? Now, of course, they're doing this because your brain is getting better. I mean, it's not random. They're dealing with animals who are maturing, organisms who are maturing, have more brain power, more capacity. Not surprising, you get more to do and more complicated things to do. However, also in response to the increased maturation of the child, who's, they're getting better able to manage themselves also, so you start taking the contextual supports away. You remove the context, so you go from a very tightly controlled, circle-bound kindergarten to a homeroom teacher, to team teaching in the middle school, to you're essentially going to independent courses at the high school. So there are two things operating, and it isn't enough in some cases to write recommendations for managing content if it isn't content that's killing the kid. Some kids can do the work, they can't do it in that classroom setting. And for parents who have money, a private school setting may be indicated. So here is our model, brain-context interaction operating around development, which, as we all know, is a dynamic, floaty sort of thing, non-linear. That's the best I could do on a non-linear image. The management cascade that we work with is we think in terms of a neurobehavioral disorder, but we look at its psychological manifestations. So, for example, I may say that the child has a pervasive neurodevelopmental disorder in the context of spina bifida, right, which captures what's going on. It's brain and it's change in development and the disease we know, the disease entity we know. But then I will need to say, how is it manifest? In other words, so I would be saying that it is manifest primarily in problems with integration, working memory, and executive function or something like that. And then I would have to highlight for the family or the reader what the risks were associated with the integration problem, the working memory problem, and the executive problem, and how they might interact, and how they relate to the real life of this child, i.e. the problems at sixth grade. You don't write recommendations for sixth grader if your kid's only seven. In the management game, my biggest single intervention, I think, is probably the education of the family, telling the story. I'm actually personally very interested in the whole issue of narrative and meaning-making, and feel very strongly that if we can't make the story that we tell about brain and development meaningful to the family, then we don't empower them, which is, of course, the whole point of education. So the goal is to share your knowledge in a way that it can be understood, tell the story as best you can, thinking in terms of the neurobehavioral capability of the kid, the systemic interactions that the kid is going to be in, and the fact that they're going to have to change developmentally whether they like it or not. And what you're aiming for here is understanding, empathy, and empowerment, especially empowerment, which comes from the other two. And this is the story, how do brains work and how do children develop. And as professionals, we try and keep up with the literature so we know what exactly the answers to these questions are. But some very basic answers to the question are, how do brains work? They only work in a context. They work in the real world, the brain in the psychological test environment or the brain in the fMRI tube are not real world experiences, and it's our job to extrapolate from one context to the other one. And brains go everywhere you go. You can't sort of take your top of your head off and put your right hemisphere down for a rest. You take your brain everywhere you go with you, and all your behavior is determined by this brain. And if this brain has got a big glitch in it, the glitch is going to go with you as well. And how do children develop? Well, you have to think in terms of there is both the bodies and the brains are under maturational forces, and that those will play a role in what the child can and cannot do at a given point. All children must meet expectable developmental challenges. And you probably don't have a sense of why this is important, but it is, I'll give you an example. One of the biggest problems that we have in working with parents with children with brain tumor, for example, or leukemia, is that under the impact of this severe life-threatening disorder that is terrifying, parents have a tendency to put parenting on hold, right? Parents sort of want to be nice to the kid until the disease has been cured, right? And parenting is on hold. And unfortunately, you can end up two or three years later with a real brat. And it isn't any good any longer. You know, 3 years down the line when nobody knows they had a brain tumor or leukemia, they aren't terribly appreciated being so bratty, right? Parents need support in giving children limits and, you know, all children need limits for their brains to work best. They certainly need more limits, not less limits, if you've had to deal with a major brain condition. So you need to think about things like that, that they have to be, kids have to be developing even with these huge disorders. It's also important, parents don't often come and talk to you about being terrified of sexual victimization in a low IQ kid who's on a marching to a very different drummer. They don't even have to be that low IQ, they can still be judgment out to lunch. And parents are, in my experience, incredibly grateful when you sort of say, okay, now let's talk about sex. You know, how are we going to manage the periods here or the changes in body of the boy here? How are you going to, you know, let's talk about sexual victimization. Almost every parent with an impaired kid worries about that. And kids who are impaired are very vulnerable to victimization because they're typically desperate for a friend. And so they just play into even the, you know, it doesn't have to be a particularly predatory other kid. It could just be a kid under their own hormonal control who doesn't know how to manage it. And all kids have to meet the not so expectable challenges that there are their own personal goals. And the personal goals that you can set up for yourself tend to be very much related to your competencies and the expectations people have for your competencies. What is the goal of all this? Well, all this in the clinical arena is I'm trying to help families find the most effective way to create that comfortable, competent an adult, I'm not really interested in the world's greatest third grader, who cares? Greatest sixth grader, I'd like that 25-year-old to be able to do what 25-year-olds do as best they can. And what is my job? What is the recipe for all of this? Well, my recipe is you have to have respect, empathy, compassion, and imagination to do my job as well as I think it can be done. And when you try and work to very high standards of that, it can be enormous fun. And on that, I will leave you for today. Thank you.